You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello and welcome to another new episode of the Step Over Pod. I am Jim Adair. With me as always is Max. In game one, the Sixers looked like crap-a-port, but in game two, it looked like they were back-a-port.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, no, it was a long topical one, and it was very bad. Yeah, very topical, you know? It's like, I'm like a late-night host. It was very Jay Leno of me, because Jay Leno was the worst one. But yeah, we are back. This is our first mid-playoff, playoffs in action pod. Game one and game two. Very, very different games. We are currently recording this is Wednesday, so game three is tomorrow. Most of you will probably end up hearing it when game three is today. So happy game three day, everybody. We saw two very different teams, two very different games. Before we get into kind of more individual things about those and the games going forward, what were kind of like the big takeaways for you, Max, from game one and game two, or maybe even just taking them together? How do you feel about the way the team is playing and the team as they are right now?
You know, to be honest, it's kind of hard to know what to take from it, just because I feel like this is kind of what we talked about last time, but I feel like it's kind of been the story throughout the season, where there just hasn't been a common narrative or theme or whatever. It's felt really disjointed, right? Like, they look really good for three or four games straight or for a couple weeks, and then go through a stretch where they don't and go back and forth within that. And like, I'm not totally convinced, like, oh, they've turned the corner, but right. I thought this was the most I feel like they've played like a team in the last maybe 3 weeks. You know, it just felt like, I felt like they moved the ball better. I felt like they just looked less disjointed. I feel like because the starting five haven't really played together much, because between Mike Scott and Boban and even Jonah Bolden, like, a lot of these guys weren't even in the rotation really. And I feel like it's not only is the starting five like relatively untested together, but then you also have the majority of your bench are guys who were not playing minutes 2.5 months ago, or just weren't on the team. I felt like this was promising in the sense that, you know, obviously they hit shots. You got production from guys who'd really been struggling. But I think the more impressive thing to me was, like, it just felt like things flowed. They got open looks. There weren't as many like miscommunications as I feel like there were in game one. Game one was just like, it felt like the Sixers were reacting to the Nets instead of the other way around, and we're just struggling to do so, and we're getting flustered, and I didn't see as much of that in game two, obviously, because they pretty much dominated. But it felt late in day, and I think beyond like any individual performances, it was really just that, I don't know, things flowed a lot better. It didn't feel like in game one they just relied so much on Jimmy Butler because they had to, and even that wasn't great. Like, Jimmy was hitting shots and getting to the rim and getting fouled, but like, it felt like he was having to make something happen. Whereas game two felt like things were just happening,
right,
for the Sixers.
Yeah. I mean, I just pulled up the box score for both games. And you can just, you know, really the game one was a tale of two quarters, essentially really a tale of one quarter. That quarter being the first quarter, when they were going in down nine, they actually outscored Brooklyn in the second and fourth quarters, but were just barely outscored by them in the third. But it's just the way they played was just abysmal, basically, right? And I think it's kind of like you said, it's kind of like how this team has been recently with the ups and downs, because we've seen four different teams in this series, right? We saw the game one and game two Nets and the game one and game two Sixers. The Sixers were both the worst of the four and the best of the four in these two games. The worst team we've seen on the floor this series has been the game one Sixers, and the best team we've seen by far has been the game two Sixers, right? Just looking at very basic numbers, in game one, their effective field goal percentage was 42.4%. In game two, it was 60.7%. You're most likely going to end up splitting the difference there somewhere. And I think if you do split that difference, you'll mostly be fine. I think they are closer to that game two team, definitely on paper and in most times on the court. But they really just got to beat away the demons that that got them into that game one performance, because it was just awful across the board. You're not going to win many games when you shoot 12% from three, no matter how well or poorly the other team shoots as well. Now, they shot 42%, but when you were 3-for-25 from distance, you're not going to win very many games. And they were still only, I mean, they were almost 40%, 39.1% in game two, which is much better, but it still wasn't as good as Brooklyn in either game. In both games, Brooklyn has shot, there was 42% from three and 41.7, basically right around the same. That being consistent over two games is scary. There will, you hope, and it's likely there'll be some regression there, along with some progression from the Sixers in that front, because they are generally on the season were a team that defended the three well. But that's not something that you can let happen, because if you play these games tighter, and like you say, you split the difference between game one and game two, and the Nets are just the Nets as they have been, you're a lot more likely to win a game if they're not making 43-44% of the three-pointers. But yeah, I think game one was the absolute worst-case scenario for this team, and game two was the best-case scenario. There was a lot of panic, a lot of concern, a lot of, this team could never possibly win with Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid, specifically with Ben Simmons. Like, might as well trade him now. This guy stinks. Second-year All-Star, 22 years old. Absolutely terrible, all this stuff. And then there's a lot of elation on after game two. And I do think as panic mode and as reactionary as the game one takes were, if you flip those and they came out in game one and scored like that, it would have been the same thing on the other side, right? People have been talking about, you know, are the Sixers like, are they now a favorite to win a championship, right? They came out and scored, they went 21-2, 2.5 minutes into the third quarter. Like, that's a very hard thing. That doesn't happen very often. Especially with a team who, like, consistently is not... You watch so many other teams in the playoffs, and every team pretty much that's in the playoffs, this is the cream of the crop, has a player that basically who you had hoped Markelle Fultz was going to be, right? Not to bring up he who should not be named, but you look at Dame Lillard, right? You look at Jamal Murray. These guys who can do essentially what Jimmy Butler ended up doing in game one, right? Where you just take somebody off the dribble, you kind of stare them down, you slowly work them, and you do these step backs or take these jumpers or drive. But Butler can't be relied on to do that because, first of all, he's just, in more often than not, is not being your point guard. And he's also just used a lot more efficiently in other facets of the game. And not having a player like that, I think, might end up being their downfall in this playoffs in general. And that would be a huge thing in the postseason. But, like, you see players, I mean, at the same time, a lot of teams don't have a Joel Embiid and don't have a Ben Simmons. But when you watch guys do something like that, when you watch the way Damian Lillard's been playing, and you're just like, shit, if there was just like a guy who was like half of that, I'd feel so much better about this team, you know? And that's the stuff that's kind of scary, because that's, you know, quite frankly, that's what D'Angelo Russell is, right? And I think that's why the Nets just look more like your standard playoff NBA team, right? They're built like that, 1-5. And the Sixers have a weird construction. And that's kind of been the issue with them, you know, over this year and last year, right? They have a weird construction. Part of that is because Ben Simmons isn't a shooting point guard and he's that big. And part of that is just because of the way the team is built, because you can always, you know, you could have focused on bringing a guy in who can do that kind of stuff. It's also because Markelle Fultz is non-existent, and he was the guy who was going to be doing that. So they kind of are really an outlier in the playoffs in general. They're built in a weird way, which could be work really well to their advantage, as we saw in Game 2, and work against them, as we saw in Game 1.
Yeah, I thought too, like, consistently through both games, it kind of ended up being what we said was maybe the worst case scenario, or the scenario where we saw maybe the Nets having an avenue to contend to win the series. And that was mm-hmm. like guys other than D'Angelo Russell stepping up, right? Like Caris right. LeVert and Spencer Dinwiddie, and that's really happened.
Joe Harris.
Point. Yeah, Joe Harris. It's like, and that has basically, well, off the, I mean, their bench has scored, like, I think they're averaging almost 70 points a game, and some of that is a little inflated because they were playing bench guys the entire fourth quarter of that game, and, like,
right.
Shabazz Napier came off the bench and scored, like, 13 in the fourth. That didn't matter, but, like, they're doing what you would expect them to do if they were going to sneak into a first round win, the Nets.
Right.
Because they weren't going to do it with just D'Angelo Russell. It was going to be the Sixers are game planning against D'Angelo Russell, and everyone else kind of just steps up and plays their role, and it's like a Celtics kind of thing that the Sixers right. just can't seem to stop. And they've done that, and obviously in Game 1, they crushed the Sixers, and in Game 2, they shot 42% from 3. Their bench was solid throughout, and they lost by 22, and yeah. the Sixers, you know, I don't think they'll, like you said, they're not going to shoot 61% effective field goal percentage. They're not going to score 145 points, but like if they can just keep up with that, I mean, the Nets basically through two games have played as well as you could expect them to play offensively, at least, and have done the things you would expect them to do if they were going to compete in the series. And the Sixers, I think, don't need a performance like Game 2 every time, but like really that Game 1 performance, I feel like, was such an outlier in the other direction that I guess that doesn't concern me in the same way that Game 2 doesn't make me go, oh, they've turned the corner. Right. But I think seeing the Nets do all this and it basically having taken the Sixers completely shitting the bed in Game 1 to get that win mm-hmm. makes me feel a little bit better just about like where the series is at and confident that the Sixers, as long as they don't shit the bed three more times, will get out of the series.
Right. And, you know, what you're saying about the bench and stuff, that is terrifying, right? Because single game plus minuses are a relatively useless stat, right? Because, for example, in the game where the Nets lost 145-123, obviously most of their team is going to have a negative plus minus. The only players that had positives were Shabazz Napier, Theo Pinson, and Zanon Musa, who all played the exact same amount of garbage time minutes, and they were all plus 8 because they were all in there as a unit. Everyone else is in negatives. But the scary thing is, if you look at Game 1, now, to be fair, Rodions Kurucs and Jared Allen started the game, but they both played the two least minutes of any player that played. But the only player in the quote-unquote starting five who had a positive plus-minus was Damari Carroll. And the only bench player who played who didn't have a positive plus minus of at least 16 was Travion Graham. Dinwiddie was plus 17. Jared Dudley was plus 16. Ed Davis was plus 28. Caris LeVert was plus 18. And the Sixers are built basically to be the opposite of that. So when you're in situations where the Sixers obviously have a very powerful, and especially when they're really clicking, they have a really, really great starting five, and the rest is kind of just noise. And the Nets are the opposite. The Nets are built, you know, the way like you would say the Celtics were, like you brought that up. They're built where their starting five isn't necessarily their five best players. And that can be really dangerous, especially when you have, you know, bench unit versus bench unit out there. And that's when bad things happen. So that's a concern going forward, too. But I did want to ask this. I believe, Max, before we get into kind of talking about going forward, and we'll take a quick break in a second, but I wanted to ask you, give you the opportunity. I believe, and I may be incorrect, did you say, for this series, did you say Sixers in five or Sixers in six?
I believe I said Sixers in five. Were you Sixers in six?
I was in five. Do you want to redo your position?
I don't.
I don't
think,
want
I think
to.
They win. I think they win in five still.
I don't. I think Brooklyn comes out and wins game three, honestly, after being quite frankly embarrassed, after the Sixers were quite frankly embarrassed and there's trade that back and forth. They will be in Brooklyn. I expect there to be a decent cadre of Sixers fans that made the trip up. I hope so. But being in home court, having those extra days off to really stew in that loss, I think the Nets will squeak this one out, and then the Sixers run the table in the rest of the series. So I'm changing it to Sixers in six.
Okay.
I know it betrays my whole fuck you winning the chip attitude, which I did carry through game one, by the way. People get very mad at me online about it, but I'm like, look, I'm having fun here. Had a couple of ciders watching the game with my friends, having a good time. So I'll change it to six, but I still think they get the series.
I respect the Sixers in six, but I think, I guess for me, I'd be pretty concerned if they lose game three. Like, if they drop one, I would hope that it's game four or five, because if they come out after game two and are just like, oh, we're good, and get complacent, and the Nets are the ones who are, you know, motivated coming off of game two, I just feel like that's a really bad sign. Like, they got absolutely embarrassed in game one. To come out strong in game two and then just, like, immediately take their foot off the gas would surprise me. I think if they get up 2-1, I could see that. Or even 3-1.
I don't see it being a take a foot off the gas situation. I think I see it being a really physical and chippy game, as we have seen things happen so far. I see maybe there being some tease, maybe there being some extracurriculars going on of some sort. And I think it's just because it's an ugly game that the Nets eke out. I don't think it's going to be a decisive win for either team, actually, quite frankly. By the way, that's like the fifth time I say quite frankly. And with that and the receding hairline, I think I've been possessed by the spirit of Stephen A. Smith. But yeah, I don't see this being crazy decisive for either team. Hope I'm wrong, obviously, in the Sixers' advantage. But I could see this being a nail-biter, just kind of, you know, street brawl, like a, you know, 103-101 game that the Nets eke out, and then the Sixers just come back and you know, guns blazing and take the rest of the series.
I like that in today's NBA, a 103-101 is like a hard fought. It's like a 10-7 NFL game from 10 years ago.
Yeah, actually, so this is a quick aside. Actually, you know what? We'll get to that in a second. Let's take a quick break.
Let's do that.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries.
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on, and there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
All right, we're back. Quick aside, maybe I should have fact-checked on that break, but I'm not going to. I read a piece, I believe it was from the LA Times, when I was eating lunch yesterday, and it was about the Clippers, I believe, television broadcaster, whose name I cannot recall, who often has the kind of the go-to line during his broadcast to, you know, more often than not, first team to 100 wins. And it was about, you know, is that factually correct? Whoever wrote this did, I believe it was the LA Times, you can look this up, and I apologize for not knowing the person's name either. They looked at the last 23 years of NBA basketball, so it was like 27,000 games. And it turns out the team that reached 100 first won 94% of the games.
Wow.
And now you could think to yourself, okay, well, teams used to reach 100 a lot less frequently, so maybe it was like 100 to 98. So obviously, they didn't reach 100 first one. or 104 to 85. Obviously, that's the case too. So, but just so it is happening less. But even over just the last 3 years, it's 88% of games, which is kind of wild when you think about it. Especially when you look at, you know, look at the, you know, put the point differential aside. It was 145-123 in Sixers Nets. So that's, you know, to be able to have that still kind of be 88% accurate is wild. But they did look into, I think they looked at it as if you were to take that 94% number or whatever and kind of apply it to today's modern NBA, what point is it at now? And it's, I think it's 94% of the time, the first team to score 114 is the team that will win the game. That's okay. the more accurate. But yeah, I thought that was actually pretty interesting. That's the kind
that
of shit
I That is doing. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so let's just talk about specifically what you want to see from the Sixers going forward against, you know, game planning, any kind of rotation changes you want to see. There haven't really been, honestly, kind of shockingly, outside of James Ennis returning from injury, there really wasn't much rotation change from game one to two. And it was more just, you know, there was some defensive scheming that went on, just shutting them down more and just, you know, honestly just fucking playing harder and better. But is there anything that stands out to you that you want to see, you know, game three, four, five, six, if seven, specifically Brett, you know, focus in on, pull back from, something you just think they need to specifically do to kind of like really, really lock this up?
Yeah, I mean, I the biggest thing is I just want to see Ben Simmons continue to be aggressive.
Right.
Because I think that was really what made the difference in the beginning of the game was he was able to just make things happen. And
he was huge, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I think when he's not doing that, it's so easy for defenses. When he's not attacking like that, it's so easy for defenses to kind of just sag off and not have to really focus in on him. And it was
literally right out of the gate. I remember as soon as the tip-off started, and this is not really something you see very often in the NBA, where he caught the tip and then ran with it.
Yeah.
Usually, it's like one of those things where, you know, every once in a while there's like a story of like some coach that won like states in Missouri by just having his kids play full court press all game. And they're always like, well, why would you give them the whole court to come up? You play defense. And everyone's like, we fucking hate you. Shut up. But it's like the idea of like when you take the tip off, it's like an understood thing that like, you bring the ball up and you let the defense get set. And Ben Simmons was just like, fuck that. Why am I doing that? And that's really not something you see very often. So as soon as that happened, I'm like, all right, he's in his own head in a good way.
Yeah. No, that's the biggest thing. And I don't know if that's something Brett Brown can really do. I'd say, like, in terms of rotation, I like that they didn't play TJ McConnell. I mean, they played him in the fourth quarter when the game was in hand. He was one of those guys who finished the last 10 minutes or whatever, but along with Korkmaz and Simmons. And speaking of guys who finished at the end, why did Zaire Smith not play those 10 garbage minutes? Like, that was inexplicable.
He was inactive.
Why was he inactive?
With Ennis back, I think they chose to make Zaire inactive over making Jonathan Simmons inactive.
That's a better question. Is why that? Why Jonathan Simmons at this point?
I didn't realize
because yeah,
he was in a suit.
Huh? I just didn't notice that. Yeah, I don't get what Jonathan Simmons really brings to the table, and like hopefully you're only playing Jonathan Simmons as a victory cigar or whatever the opposite of that, the defeat cigarette,
sure.
Defeat pipe. I guess I just don't really understand why you'd even activate Jonathan Simmons. Cause if Ennis gets hurt or someone else gets hurt or someone's playing poorly and you want to, you know, go to the next guy, I would think that would be McConnell playing more minutes or maybe Korkmaz. I don't really see what Simmons gives you that any of those guys don't. At least get Zaire in there. Also, I'd rather play Zaire than Jonathan Simmons just straight up, but especially if it's garbage time. But I guess going back to stuff that actually matters, I thought TJ McConnell not playing was probably for the best. I don't think he's really equipped to defend D'Angelo Russell, which is really like the only thing you'd want him doing out there, other than shooting his little 12-footer. You know, you bring him in there for defense and intensity, but it's like he can't stick with D'Angelo, so it just doesn't just doesn't make sense. Against the Raptors, if they make it to that series and the Raptors win, I think against Lowry, like that's I think where maybe McConnell has, you know, has some there's a positive to bringing him in for 15 minutes off the bench. I don't really see it in this series.
No, I agree. And I think we talked about this before. I know I at least talked about it off pod about how, honestly, you're going to have it's the one of the goals of playing in the playoffs is to never have, or in very rare occasions, if the game is within striking distance for you or you're trying to keep the team at bay, basically have a starter on the floor at all times. And with that in mind, I think, you know, I know we talked about it off pod, I'm pretty sure, but maybe on pod as well, that like your best backup point guard option is Jimmy Butler. And you saw that obviously in game one. He tried to put the team on his back. Really the only reason they were even close at the end, but it wasn't enough. You know, he scored, what do you have, 36 points. And then game two, where the whole team played much better, he only had 7 points. He was 3 of 10 shooting, but, you know, he had 7 assists. He was making himself active on the defensive end. He was, like, fell into, like, a equally important role without having to play hero ball to try to eke the game out, mm-hmm. which I thought was great. You know, you look at the numbers, you're like, oh, he had less points than J.J. McConnell, but in almost triple the minutes, but he played an all-around game of impactful basketball that just really fit in with the way they were playing, too. So, yeah, I think that's huge. I think Tobias getting out of a slump at a nice time is helpful. Hopefully that continues to go. Obviously, Embiid being able to play and being able to play, you know, legit minutes is big. I know, like, Boban was, you know, unreal and, like, hilariously great, 16-8 in the last game. But ideally, you probably don't want Boban out there for almost 20 minutes. I mean, Boban played 18-15 and Joel played 20-55. That was because, like, Joel would have had to play more if that game wasn't in hand. But you kind of want to be on the other side of that where you don't have to play Boban that much in a tight game based around health, right? That becomes a concern. So that's something that worries me a little bit. But I think if they stay healthy, if they kind of stick with what worked in game two and then react, you know, then I think they're in good shape. I think it's more about, at this point, reacting to how the Nets react. Because you know, it's a tie series and you're going to Brooklyn. But, I mean, to me, and I think to a lot of observers of the series now, it feels like the Sixers have the upper hand just because of how demonstrative they played in game two.
I agree. I thought, speaking of Boban, low key, he has been, other than Mike Scott, like their most important role player off the mm-hmm. bench. You know, I kind of feel like I almost want to see them play Boban more than they're playing him now. I don't really know where you find the minutes for that, but right. You know, he played 18 minutes in this last game, put up 16-9. What went like 4 of 5 from mid range. You know, I just, I feel like he makes things happen and he kind of changes the dynamic when he's in. Mm-hmm. I think if they can get Embiid, I thought the 21 minutes he played in this last game, it was like pretty ideal. He seemed more like himself throughout the game. And like, if they need to do that, if they need to limit him to 20 minutes to make right. that happen and to keep him healthy for now, obviously if they advance in the playoffs, I'd like to see that change. But like in this series, if you need to play Embiid 20 minutes and play Boban 24 and Bolden and whatever else for the remaining few minutes, like go ahead and do that. I feel like the fact that you have Boban, and not that he's anywhere near the level of Joel Embiid, but like just having a guy who is a bit of a difference maker and at least has some things that makes the defense have to change what they're doing when he's in the game. Like I think that affords you the ability to not have to overexert Embiid. And I thought in the first game they did that a little bit with Embiid. There were times where he just seemed kind of gassed or not himself.
Yeah. I think it's good to keep it fairly brief today. Just about a half hour now. Just kind of keep it. You don't want to harp too much on. There's a lot of series still left. So if you don't have anything else to say, and any other points, you want to take a couple of questions, Max?
Yeah. Sure.
All right, cool. So I hate to open with this one, but I do think it is interesting. We don't have to harp on it too much. at Booby Styles, who we both know, asked, would you consider trading Ben Simmons for De'Aaron Fox, Buddy Hield, and a future first? Now, before we even get into this, I will say that the idea of trading Ben Simmons in his second year, in his first All-Star appearance year, when he is still growing as a player, still coming into his zone, and showing still this is the player he is even now, is out of my mind bonkers. However, I don't think the Kings would do this. De'Aaron Fox, Buddy Hield, and a future first is a lot to give up for somebody, especially the way Hield and De'Aaron Fox both came into their own in the last season and a half, basically. So I would not, but that is probably about as close to an enticing but also semi-realistic offer as you could probably pitch me on.
Yeah, I feel like if they were to do it, and I think obviously there was a lot more talk about this after game one than there will be now with Simmons, but like if they were to move on from Ben Simmons, I feel like it has to be a consolidating pieces move. Like, I just think trading someone with his potential, I don't feel that way about, you know, if you brought back Jimmy and in a year you want to trade him, like that to me is really different. Ben Simmons is a possibly like transcendent superstar in the league, and I just think if you're giving that up, you need to be getting back someone who at least has the potential to reach that level, and I don't think De'Aaron Fox or Buddy Hield has that. I think both of them at best are, you know, let's say like Kyle Lowry, to use his name again, like Kyle Lowry level stars, not Kawhi Leonard level stars, which is what Ben Simmons is.
They're probably not foundational.
No, exactly. And I think they'd be great. Like, the fit would be awesome. Like, having, I mean, and maybe the Sixers have reached the point where you need to start considering that, they're, that beyond long term, there's like an immediate, that probably makes you more of a contender than you are now if you did that for next season. But I just think you could do better. I think there will be a star who comes available in the next year. And if you're looking to trade Ben Simmons, you can do that for that star. And that'll be the most enticing offer, because who's going to trade more than a 23-year-old superstar in the making?
Yeah. The next question, which I think is fun, this is from at I Am Grum. If Joel Embiid had elbowed you two as hard as he did Jared Allen, how far would your jaw land away from your body? Imagine it's an open field, so there's no fan interruption or walls that can you could bounce up against.
Are we to assume this is in a vacuum as well, like most physics equations?
I would assume so, yeah. So let's say that. I would say, so, Max, have you seen Jason Takes Manhattan?
No.
Okay, so it's Friday the 13th movie, Jason Takes Manhattan. He's on a boat for most of the movie. There's very little Manhattaning going on. But at the very end, they are in Manhattan. They're on this rooftop, and there's this guy, pretty sure he's wearing a windbreaker, who just, like, he wants to box Jason. This is, like, his grand strategy to defeat this like, you know, guy with barnacles on his head. It's, like, obviously he killed all his friends. He's like, oh, I'm gonna just fist fight this guy. That'd be great. So he punches him a bunch, and Jason, like, isn't affected by it. And then he's, like, tired and puts his hands. He goes, all right, give me your best shot. And Jason uppercuts him and punches his head off of his shoulders. And the head goes flying. And that's what would happen to me.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it would just be my jaw. I would, like, my head would go full like Jack Skellington. Like, it would just fall off and roll across the court or the field or wherever we are where this is happening. Yeah. I would definitely never play basketball again if that happened to me.
Yeah. At Schicky, Ryan Schick asked, who all on the current team's roster would you rather have Jakar Sampson take their spot instead? I think we probably have the same one, at least, maybe two answers.
I might have more than that.
Jonathan Simmons and TJ McConnell for me.
Ooh, man, TJ would not be in my top two.
You don't think so?
I think Furkan Korkmaz.
Yeah, but like, here's the thing. So he takes Korkmaz's spot. So it's like, oh, congratulations, you got a minute and a half a game.
Oh, you're saying, I just thought it was on the roster, and then I can choose to not play TJ McConnell.
Oh, I took it a different way.
Okay.
I took it a different way. You can take whatever way you want.
He did
ask spot and not minutes, so I just kind of assumed and probably assumed wrongly.
Yeah, if you're talking role, then yeah, like if he could play James Ennis or TJ McConnell's role, that would be ideal to me. There are probably like five guys on the roster that I give up right now. Like I would give up Greg Monroe. I'd give up Furkan Korkmaz. I'd give up Jonah Bolden. I'd give up Jonathan Simmons. And am I missing anyone?
Amir.
Yeah, I give up Amir 100%.
Like inactive.
Yeah. But, no. Amir's out. And am I missing anyone else? Zaire, but I'm not going to... Obviously, like, there's a future component of that. But if it's just for this round, sure. I'd drop Zaire if it meant having... just for this series or for the rest of the playoffs. It kind of sucks because I feel like if they had... Even, like, Anderson. Like, Justin Anderson would be an actual rotation piece for the Sixers this year who's useful in these playoffs. So it kind of sucks they've run through, like, between him, Jeremy Grant, Jakar... they've kind of left themselves without any wing depth.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, you say Justin Anderson would have been helpful this year, but, you know, he was quote-unquote helpful last year, and how far did they go at the same time? You know, the team's obviously better this year, but, like...
I thought he should have played more. Better. I guess he got hurt last year, but I thought it was weird that he didn't play more to begin with last year.
It seemed like his job in round one was just to annoy the hell out of Dwayne Wade.
So. Yeah.
Dr. Bunsen Honeydew at Big Head Ted asked... this is probably more for you because I don't travel a ton, but I do have an answer for this, which is favorite opposing stadium / venue you've ever been to and why? Any sport. Thinking, because you have many, many more to think about, I will just say that mine is Wrigley Field, which I went to when I was like 10 years old for free on an airplane, obviously, because I won a paper airplane flying contest. I was one of a dozen winners of a paper airplane flying contest, and the prize was a day trip to Chicago.
This whole situation sounds like it was 1937.
It does.
Like,
yeah.
You won a paper airplane flying contest and were brought to Chicago, where you went to Wrigley Field to watch the Cubs play.
For the World's Fair, obviously.
Yes.
on a real live aeroplane. Yeah, no, we just did that. It was really cool. Cubs, Phils... I think it was one of the years that Mickey Morandini was on the Cubs. I could be swapping that with Doug Glanville in my head. It might be that. Probably Glanville, actually. Makes more sense, yeah, time-wise. But yeah, Wrigley Field.
It's tough because I don't really like baseball, and I feel like that's, you know, that's where the unique, you know, stadiums,
yeah, that's
parks,
what the
or
character
are.
Is, yeah, when it comes to the actual venue itself.
Yeah, like, I've been to Wrigley, and Wrigley's really cool, but I wouldn't say it was, like, my favorite experience. I'd probably say Madison Square Garden. Like, it just, there's something really cool about it. It's a unique-looking arena. The energy when it's a good game is really solid. Like, I've been to Sixers games there. Other than that, I actually really like the old Sleep Train Arena, the old King. Before, I haven't been to the new Kings Arena, but their old arena was actually kind of cool. It was like a piece of shit, but it kind of reminded me of the Spectrum a little bit. But it had like literally like wooden bleachers like leading up to the floor goes like right up to where the seats start, and then there was like just the whole thing was so janky. It kind of like had a lot of like palestra like fixtures and stuff just because it was so old and like cement and wood and stuff. I thought that was cool. Other than that, I'd probably say Moda Center, Rose Garden, in Portland is really cool. There's like kind of a similar vibe. It's like a little bit older and just packed, and it's a basketball focused arena instead of being like a hockey arena that can also have basketball.
Yeah, those combo arenas are like when you had a cafeteria / auditorium in grade school, you know, combo thing. Just got a couple more. This was from at StakeCSS215, and I had to ask for clarification on this. It says, how do you feel about being known more for an ad on a podcast rather than an actual podcast? So I sent that tweet to you and two of our friends, Patrick and John Bartrid, and John clarified that apparently, our ad plays all the time on a bunch of different of the SB Nation Network podcasts, which is cool. One, it's cool, but two, man, it makes me wish that we did a better job with that ad.
Yeah, good thing I don't listen to podcasts, or that would be that'd be really embarrassing to have to hear that all the time.
Don't actually listen to sports podcasts. That is true. Nothing against people who do them, but yeah. So yeah, if you hear our voice all the time on other podcasts and you're annoyed by it, like, I guess our bad, but also not our fault.
True.
And also listen to the Step Over Pod.
What's our last question?
Our last question is from Andrew Quinlan at Andrew Quinlan 3. Which Sixer from last year's team, excluding Coven Dario, would help the most right now? So, just so you're aware, if you exclude Coven Dario, the only people who played any playoff minutes last year that aren't here this year, specific to the playoffs only, are Jared Bayless, Rashawn Holmes, Markel Fultz, Justin Anderson, Bellinelli, and Ilya Sova. But then also, if you go to the regular season, you have Timotei Luwawu-Cabarrot, you have Trevor Booker, you have James Young, you have Nick Stauskas, you have Jahlil Okafor, you have James Michael McAdoo, you have Jacob Poulin. I think, honestly, like to me, that's got, it just basically comes down to Bellinelli, Ilya Sova. And honestly, I think I'd go with Ersan on that one.
I would too.
Yeah, because Bellinelli has the long distance shooting, obviously, and that definitely helped in the playoffs last year. But I think, you know, taking charges for one, offensive boards for another. He's a much worse free throw shooter, but I think that Ilya Sova would just offer you a little bit more. Not the world's greatest decision maker when it comes to when to attempt three-pointers sometimes. But I think he would just give you more, especially. And I think he might fit this roster, honestly, a little bit better.
I agree with all of that. Also, I'd love to see Ersan Ilyasova and Boban out on the floor together, just grabbing, popping flat-footed rebounds, tapping them to each other seven times in a row before finally coming down with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you on that. So that's all we got. I guess we should probably wrap it up. We will obviously be watching the series as it shakes out. We will probably just feel it out, see how the series looks for when we actually do our next one. And then, yeah, we will talk to you next time as the series unfolds. And hopefully there will not be any sense of panic in our voices next time you hear them.
I really hope so.
I hope so, too. So thanks for listening, and we will talk to you then.
Right. See ya.